All right, well, today we're at Ruth chapter 4, the last chapter in the book of Ruth, and I'll just warn you, I have too much. I already know that. We're going to do our best, but for once, this is not on like a communion Sunday or when there's a testimony, so that's good. But hang with me. Here's what's going to happen. Next week, we're actually going to do one more week in this series where we're kind of going to do a recap and look back. I want a chance just to talk about sort of in view of the whole book, some of the big themes, as well as to think about the role that this plays within the wider story of redemption. So we'll have one more week to wrap up next week. This week, we're going to get to chapter 4. It's going to take some faith on your part because it's going to take a little while. But what I'd like to do is I want to try and recap how we got here so far. So maybe you've missed a week, maybe not. Just this will be, I hope, a helpful reminder. I want to set the stage for what happens in chapter 4. So I need a little time to do that. But the way I want to do it is I want to go back to the framework we've talked about since the first week. All right, so we talked about this idea that before Israel always, there's these two paths, the path of faithfulness and the path of unfaithfulness. I think for our purposes this morning, it might be helpful to think of it like this, just to reframe it a little bit, that lots of people in the story over and over are faced with a decision. They have to choose between what we might call costly loyalty on the one hand, and what is comfortable and easy for them on the other, all right? So they're repeatedly facing this choice, costly loyalty or what looks better, what looks easier and less risky for them. So for example, chapter 1, all right? Naomi's husband and her sons, they have all died. Naomi decides to return to Bethlehem, and right away, Ruth and Orpah, but for our purposes, primarily Ruth is immediately faced with this decision, right? There is a costly loyalty option, which is she can stay with Naomi. She knows Naomi is older, she's past childbearing age, that if she and Orpah stay, that Naomi will be totally alone. And so the costly option is to stay with Naomi and to become a foreigner in her country. There's also a much easier, more comfortable option for Ruth, which is to do, in fact, what Naomi encourages her to do, because Naomi loves her. She says, hey, it will be much easier, much less risky for you to just stay in Moab. Go back to your father's house, where someone will take care of you until you find another husband, and then you'll have someone who will provide for you, who will hopefully give you heirs, who will take care of you in your old age. It's the much lower cost, less risky, easier route for Ruth. And what does Ruth choose? Ruth chooses costly loyalty to Naomi over personal comfort and security. And listen, it's a high cost. Despite the high personal cost, the high personal risk, Ruth clings to Naomi. Now in chapter 2, they're back in Bethlehem, and immediately Ruth is confronted with the reality that they are desperately poor. They don't have food. If they are going to eat, it's going to be Ruth day in and day out in the fields, just scavenging to pick up the scraps that are left behind so they have food for that day. It's a hard life. But Ruth still has options. She could, if she wanted, just abandon her vow to Naomi. Remember, where you go, I will go, your people will be my people. She could just turn to Naomi and say, hey, I didn't realize how hard this was going to be. And even without going back to Moab, she could just marry whoever's willing to marry her there in Bethlehem, and immediately her problems go away. She will be provided for, she will have food, no more gleaning in the field. But Naomi will be alone. So there's this comfortable option, the easy option, or there's the high cost option, which for Ruth means keeping to her vow to Naomi. Because if Ruth remains faithful to her vow, that means that marriage and children can only come through a kinsman of Naomi. That means no Moabite husband. It means no other Israelite husband except these near kinsmen. And once again, Ruth chooses costly loyalty. Out of loyalty to Naomi, she chooses hard work and poverty over a quick marriage to a man outside of Naomi's family. And it's not just Ruth. In chapter 2, Boaz, I think you could argue, faces the same decision. When he finds Ruth in his fields, a foreigner, a Moabite, he could do the easy, low-cost, comfortable option, low risk. He could do the bare minimum the Torah requires. He could just let her do what she's planning to do, which is to gather scraps behind his harvesters. And actually, this is the time of the judges, so we wouldn't be surprised if he chose to do even less, which is to do nothing and to say, hey, you're a Moabite. This doesn't even apply to you. Get off my land, out of my fields. Those are certainly options, right? They're more easier for him. They cost him nothing. Or what he could do is Boaz could take the high-cost option. And that's what he does. And we're told explicitly that moved by Ruth's loyalty to Naomi, Boaz responds in kind. And so instead of the bare minimum, which costs him nothing above what he's already planning, he chooses instead to be generous. He provides for Ruth and Naomi out of what he has harvested for himself. He shares with them the food that's been prepared for his own table. He chooses costly loyalty, inspired by Ruth's choice to do the same. That brings us to chapter 3. Now here, I want to pause, and I just want to say and admit, really until preparing this week, I never really fully understood chapter 3. That is, I knew when I looked at it that I was missing something, okay? Because however you slice it, I could tell something scandalous was going on here, right? There's no getting around that. In Ruth 3, Ruth comes to Boaz. She sneaks up to him in the middle of the night where he's sleeping. She uncovers his feet and lays down next to him, right, at his feet. So look, you don't have to be an expert in cross-cultural stuff to know there's something suggestive there, right, at a bare minimum. And yet, when Boaz wakes up and finds that a woman has just laid down at his feet, what does he do? He immediately praises her. He calls her a woman of substance. And it's clear the author agrees with this evaluation. And I have to admit, for a long time, I couldn't quite understand how those two things went together. I took Boaz's word for it, but I didn't really get it. And it wasn't really until preparing for chapter 4 that I think I finally got it. And I think what helped me, and what I hope will help you, is to think of that same lens we've looked at the previous chapters through. So by the time we get to chapter 3, all right, we're told at the beginning the barley harvest and the wheat harvest are both over. That means Ruth and Naomi have been back for over 2 months, and we know from the text already, everyone in town knows they're back. Everyone in town knows their situation. Boaz certainly knew immediately. The other kinsman redeemer would have known immediately also. And yet, so far, no near kinsman has offered to redeem the family through marriage to Ruth. Even though they know there is a real urgent need for this, nobody's made a move to do it. No one has offered the high-cost option, which is to marry Ruth, buy Elimelech's land, and gift it to Ruth's offspring. So Naomi comes up with a plan, all right? She now has Ruth. I think the plan is to offer Boaz a low-cost option, a chance to provide low-cost redemption through providing an heir outside of marriage. Look, redeeming Naomi through marriage to Ruth will be costly. It's going to be costly socially, which in their world, in a small town, matters. If you've ever lived in a small town, you understand this. Ruth is a Moabite. She is a foreigner. Marrying her could bring all sorts of social cost for the kinsman who does it. There's also a real financial cost. I mean, it's worth thinking about this. If they marry Ruth, they are going to buy the land that was Elimelech's and then immediately turn it over, give it back to Naomi's family. And since no one has yet offered this high-cost redemption, including Boaz, Ruth offers him a lower-cost option. He can provide Naomi an heir by getting Ruth pregnant outside of marriage. So if he's unwilling to do the high-cost, full faithfulness thing, here's another option. Now, this is all very strange to us, but hang with me here for a minute, okay? Because this will still help Ruth. Because legally, if Ruth gets pregnant this way and has a child, that child, boy or girl, will be legally eligible to inherit Elimelech's land. Now, the problem for Ruth and Naomi is that's a long way off. That child has to become legally an adult, and even then, if they can claim the land, that child is going to grow up in poverty, and they're going to have to work their whole life to pay off the debt of getting that family land back. And that means for Ruth and Naomi, this is a commitment to at least one, probably two more decades of really severe poverty, of hard work, of gleaning for Ruth, all right? So for them, it's a very costly option. But for Boaz, it's low cost. It's less risky. All it means for him is he gets Ruth pregnant and he just walks away. So that's what's on the table here. And so what you need to think of is this. When Boaz finds Ruth there, what he sees in her actions is Ruth declaring, I am willing to endure the social stigma of being a single mother in this culture. I am willing to take on two more decades of poverty in order to remain faithful to Naomi. This is all about providing an heir for Naomi, because legally it's not going to be Ruth's kid, it's Naomi's. And Ruth is saying to Boaz, this is the cost I am willing to pay for loyalty to Naomi. And that's why when Boaz sees it, he goes, oh man. And he says to her, you are a woman of noble character, of remarkable substance. And he's moved by it. And he is moved to respond in kind. He witnesses her high-cost loyalty, and it's going to inspire him to do the same. If you think this is odd or maybe a stretch, there's a story in Genesis 38 about Judah and Tamar. All right, so sorry, this is another little bit of a complicated scenario, but it's important because Boaz is a descendant of these people. A few generations down the line, he will know this. This is part of his personal history. All right, Judah, his son marries a woman named Tamar, also a foreigner. The oldest son, however, wicked in the sight of the Lord, he dies, leaving no children. So Judah says to Tamar, hey, in keeping with the covenant, I'm going to direct my second son, Onan, to marry you so that you will have someone to provide for you and to provide an offspring. And so the second son marries, but it says explicitly in Genesis 38, this son he's irritated, he's annoyed because it says he knows this child will not legally be his. So he doesn't want to engage. He's married to her, but he takes steps to make sure she won't get pregnant. And it says, the Lord finds this evil. And so he too dies. Now, Judah has another son, but he's not an adult. And so Judah says to Tamar, hey, go back to your father's house, and when this third son is of age, we'll do the right thing, and I will give him to you as a husband. And so she does. Time goes on. Judah's wife dies. The son comes of age, and Judah does not send him to Tamar as a husband. And Tamar, over time, realizes he's never going to. And so she takes matters into her own hands. She dresses up as a prostitute. She hears Judah is going to shear his sheep, and she plants herself on his path so he will see her. And he engages her services, and she says, all right, well, what are you going to pay me? He says, well, tomorrow I'll give you a goat. And she says, yeah, I've heard that before. Give me something to keep so that I can claim that goat if you don't send it over. And he says, sure, here's my staff, here's my seal. So she performs the service. He goes back. He sends the goat the next day. She's nowhere to be found. The servant asks the locals, where'd this lady go? They said, we don't know who you're talking about. And he just kind of shrugs and moves on with life. Then 3 months later, in what has to be one of the greatest instances of hypocrisy ever, Judah hears that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant, therefore guilty of prostitution. And he says, how dare she? And he wants her put to death. Again, he knows he's engaged in prostitution. He also knows he's refused to do right by her by sending his son. And yet here, this is what he wants to do. So they bring Tamar to him, and he says, "Here, this is the staff and the seal of the guy who engaged my services, in case you're curious who he is." And Judah sees them, and do you know what he says? He doesn't say, "Oh, you know what, I've overreacted, we're all sinners here." He says, "She was more righteous than me." Not our culture, not our covenant. But the covenant obligation is to secure the line and family of Tamar and her husband. Judah has refused to be faithful to that. And Tamar has said, "You are not willing to be faithful. I will pay an even higher cost to be faithful to that. I will take on this embarrassment and this indignity to be faithful." She shames him by her faithfulness. And he recognizes it. "You are more righteous." So by the way, out of that union, we get twins, one of whom is the ancestor of Boaz. So when Boaz wakes up, all right, I got a little carried away. When Boaz wakes up and Ruth is at his feet, listen, you all have sort of embarrassing, infamous family stories that are just always right there. This one's always right there for Boaz, I promise you. He wakes up, he sees Ruth at his feet, and he immediately goes, "I almost just did a Judah," all right? Where this is, I think, the point of the plan. He is immediately confronted, "I have not done the full costly faithfulness thing, and here you, like Tamar, are saying, if you are unwilling to do it, I am willing to do it, I will pay the cost." It's gotta be, just imagine it's powerful to me. Imagine how it is to him. This is his ancestor, his family sin. He almost repeated the cycle. But in chapter 3, when he sees this decision, it's placed before him. What are you gonna do? The high cost loyalty or what's comfortable and easy for you? And Boaz says, "No, I am not repeating the cycle. It stops here." And he says, prompted, maybe even convicted by Ruth's costly loyalty to Naomi, Boaz chooses to offer full but costly redemption through marriage to Ruth. To my eye, I think what we have here, and this is part of why I think this is the right way to think about it, is it's a repeat of chapter 2 with higher stakes. In chapter 2, Ruth chooses the costly option of coming back to Bethlehem with Naomi. All right, and Boaz hears about it and he's blown away. And inspired by that, moved by her loyalty, he responds in kind. "If you are gonna show costly loyalty, I will show costly loyalty." And he is just wildly generous. Now in chapter 3, that's the same cycle again. Ruth comes to Boaz demonstrating the cost she is willing to pay out of loyalty to Naomi. And it just takes Boaz's breath away. And he says, "Man, if you are willing to pay this cost, so am I." Inspired, moved by her loyalty, Boaz responds. He offers the same thing. And so I think what he says here is great. He says to Ruth, I mean, this is how impacted he is by it. "Whatever you ask, I will do. Whatever you ask, I will do." And for what it's worth, I think this is the result that Naomi and Ruth had hoped and planned for all along. Again, this is a risky thing to do, but they show some wisdom here. They have seen Boaz's character in the past. They have seen his generosity, seen his kindness. That's why they come to him. They think, you know what? Once before Boaz responded to loyalty and kind, perhaps he will again. And he does. He does. All right. Now we're ready for chapter 4, because that's the setting. When we get to chapter 4, he has just told Ruth, "Whatever you ask, I will do." And then Ruth goes back, tells Naomi, and she says, "All right, sit and wait. He's going to take care of it." And that's what he does. I'm going to read the chapter. It says this, "Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned," so this is the guy who's closer in line than Boaz, "when he comes along, Boaz said, 'Come over here, my friend, and sit down.' So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, 'Sit here.' And they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer," so he's gathered the elders with the kinsman redeemer. This is in front of them. So he said to the kinsman redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has a right to do it except you, and I am the next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, oh, and on the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabite, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the kinsman redeemer said, well, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the legal method of recognizing the transactions in Israel. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and to all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also required Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. Then the elders and all those at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women of the town said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and cared for him. And the women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Remember, child of Judah and Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, Boaz the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David. The word of the Lord. In verses 1 through 6, the first chunk there, Boaz goes to the gate and he just waits for the other kinsman redeemer. By the way, this guy is never named. And he grabs 10 of the town elders. So I think this guy, Boaz is going where he knows this guy is eventually going to have to pass by. And sure enough, he does. And when Boaz sees him, he says, hey, friend, why don't you come over here and have a seat with some of the town elders, okay? Now, it's worth noting that this guy has so far avoided taking any action whatsoever. It's possible, we could charitably say, he's just busy with the harvest and with his own life. But it's also true that he benefits from inaction. At this point, if this guy, the closest kinsman, if he does nothing and no one else intervenes, eventually he will just inherit that land that belonged to Elimelech, at least part of it. It will be his free and clear forever, and it will cost him nothing. All he has to do is wait, and I would argue kind of pretend he doesn't know what's going on here. Because, you know, publicly, officially refusing to redeem Naomi, again, there will be a social cost to that. There will be people who will say, you know, that's not good behavior. But he's right now, it seems like it's possible. He's just kind of trying to pretend like, oh, when did they get back? You know, he's just not engaging and just biding his time. So the ideal solution for him is just to pretend he doesn't know what's going on until he inherits. So by waiting for him with the elders, Boaz is taking that option off the table. All right? This guy can still decline, but he will now have to do so officially. I mean, this will have the force of law. So to understand what's at stake here, let me just take another minute to talk about what this redemption would entail. As I've already indicated, the redemption is costly, both financially and socially. And it's important here to remember, okay, I know the book is called Ruth, but the redemption here is to restore the line and name of Elimelech and Naomi. That's the goal. It's to raise back up their name and their line together with their hereditary property. Okay, so, and because Naomi is beyond childbearing age, this is a situation that needs what they would call, or what we would call, a double surrogate. That means someone has to stand in for Naomi because she can no longer bear children, and someone has to stand in for Elimelech because he's dead. All right? So Ruth is the surrogate for Naomi. The question is, who will be the surrogate for Elimelech? It's going to be either Boaz or this other guy, or no one. Now, if you think about it, it's a little odd. The child that they're going to have, whoever that is in Ruth, biologically is not descended from Naomi or Elimelech at all, but legally, that child is their heir. That's why the women say, Naomi has a son. It is legally her son and heir. So whoever does this, whoever redeems, will do it by marrying Ruth, who is a Moabite, and that's going to come with significant social costs. And additionally, I mean, functionally, what's going to happen is they are going to buy, with their money, all of Elimelech's land and immediately turn it over to this son, Obed, it turns out, who's not Boaz's son. Legally, it belongs to this other family. They're buying land and then immediately giving it away. And I think it's worth thinking about. Boaz or this redeemer is going to buy land and give it away, when if they do nothing, they will inherit and keep it. That is a costly redemption in multiple ways. And we should note, in this guy's defense, he seems willing to pay the financial cost, which is a credit to him. But when Boaz reminds him in verse 5, hey, part of the deal is marrying Ruth the Moabite, this changes his mind. It's hard to know exactly why. Part of it might just be that he's worried it's going to hurt him financially. Part of it might be the social cost of having a Moabite wife and mother to these children. And let me just say, in our culture, it's so easy to dismiss the social cost and to go, well, you know, that'll blow over. It's really not a big deal. But for this small agrarian community, those are often the more substantial costs. And this seems to bear that out. Boaz presents the financial cost, and he goes, okay, I'll do it. And then he says, well, and marry the Moabite. And he says, actually, never mind. All right? And really, I don't have time to get into all this, but if you look in Deuteronomy 23, hanging over this whole story, and the reason probably we're reminded so many times that Ruth is a Moabite, is Deuteronomy 23, where it just says explicitly, verse 2 and 3, Moabites specifically are precluded from assembling with the people of God in the presence of God, even to the 10th generation. So there's a real social risk here. There's a risk that whoever marries her is going to slowly lose their friends. They're not going to be welcome in polite society. And maybe the people around them aren't going to do business with them. And listen, if you can't sell your barley locally, you can't sell it online. All right, that's it. That's all they've got, all right? So this is a real risk. It's not just costly, it's risky for whoever is going to take this on. And so this other guy, he declines. It is too costly. Then we get to the great moment, verses 7 through 10. Boaz, facing the same risks, the same dangers, the same costs, chooses loyalty anyway. We have in these verses, all right, what we're supposed to see, it's why we're told about the sandal thing, is that Boaz does everything the law requires carefully, openly, and fully. He told Ruth, everything you ask I will do, and then he does it to the letter of the law, just as the law requires. So he not only marries Ruth, He buys the land, he gives it away, and he proclaims this before the elders, before the town, and he calls them as witnesses. I want to emphasize one more time that this is costly to Boaz and risky. It's not only expensive now, it puts his future at risk. The costly redemption is therefore on Boaz's part, an act of great faith in Yahweh. By doing all that the law requires and more, Boaz is saying, I choose the path of costly loyalty, knowing, trusting that God, if I keep his covenant, that he will take care of me and provide for me. He chooses loyalty over his own personal comfort and security. Boaz, like Ruth before him, does that by displaying great faith in the goodness and generosity of God. In verses 11 through 12, the elders and the people respond to this costly loyalty with a blessing. I'm going to go through this part quickly, but it's very cool. It's worth looking at in a little more detail. Like the other blessings here, we get the blessing and then we immediately see God fulfilling it, right? So they say, may Ruth be like Leah and Rachel. I mean, those are the mothers of the 12 tribes of Israel. May they be like Leah and Rachel. Okay, may she be like, wow, okay. Boaz, may you be famous in Bethlehem, all right? And then the third thing, might your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Just in case we didn't catch the allusion in chapter 3, here's the explicit reference, right? And then once again, like I say with the previous blessings, in the genealogy, what we're supposed to see is that God, in fact, answers all those. He grants all of those blessings, right? He makes them the great-grandparents of King David. So what's comparable to birthing the 12 tribes? Well, birthing the greatest king in all of Israel's history, right? Famous in Bethlehem, Bethlehem today, still today, is known as the city of David, descendant of Boaz. I'd say we came through on that one, right? So that's a really cool thing. But in between those, the blessing and the genealogy, we get the conclusion to our story. And I just want to emphasize this for a moment. Boaz marries Ruth, and here we are told explicitly, here really is for the first time the explicit intervention of God. God causes her to conceive. And then look at verses 14 to 17. It's the full circle moment. This is Naomi's story from beginning to end. The women of the town say to Naomi, praise be to Yahweh, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. And man, they praise Ruth fittingly, I think, as better to her than seven, I mean, a fullness of sons. Better still is Ruth, right? And then they, of course, say, and Naomi has a son. So just to take you back, chapter 1, the very first first verses, it's grief and loss. She's lost her husband and all her children, and she is alone, and there's no one to carry on her line. Now the faithfulness of God has come through, and Naomi has a son, and they call him Obed. It's legally her son and her heir. Through the costly loyalty of Ruth and Boaz, God has provided Naomi with a son who will be the grandfather to Israel's greatest king. And so the name and line of Elimelech and Naomi has not just been raised from the dead, though it has been made famous in all Israel. Naomi's story, which began in grief and loss, now ends in joy and blessing. The love and faithfulness of God toward Naomi has been made manifest in the costly loyalty of Ruth and Boaz. All right, I want to close by trying to give us a sense, because that's the wonderful, like, just-so ending. But then, when we least expect it, the author hits us with a great little twist here. Look, I told you from the beginning, right, that this is not a story with kings and prophets. It's not a story with pillars of fire and bread raining down from heaven. There's none of that. It's a story about the everyday faithfulness of ordinary people, and that's what it is all the way up until chapter 4, verse 17. Here at the great conclusion to Naomi's story, we read that Naomi has a son, and this is wonderful and beautiful. We're so happy it's worked out this way. It's the perfect ending, and then the author hits us with a bombshell. and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. No kings until right now. All along, listen, I think this is so important and so cool. All along, this has felt like this little story with little stakes. A great story, but a little story, all right? Here at the end, though, we discover that God has in fact chosen to work through the everyday faithfulness of these ordinary people to rescue and redeem the whole nation. This story of costly loyalty, it is the answer to the bleak conclusion at the very end of the book of Judges. The last line in the book of Judges, there was no king in Israel, and each man did what was right in his own eyes. If that's the problem, plaguing the whole nation, then here is God's solution: a king with the heart like God's own. In this last chapter, the author of Ruth forces us to confront the high cost and the high risk of redemption. And only then, only after we fully appreciate how costly this is going to be, does the author show us the incredible return. Nothing less than the redemption of a whole nation. Friends, redemption is always costly. It's always costly. But in God's hands, the potential for blessing is almost limitless. And listen, I'll just close with this little teaser. A couple weeks, Advent starts. We're fortunate to know today, as we're going to start celebrating in 2 weeks, that Naomi will have another even more famous descendant than David, and his name is Jesus. And like his forebears, he will pay a very high cost, but through him, God will redeem nothing less than the whole world. Would you close with me in prayer? Thanks for hanging in there. God, I'm so grateful for your word. I'm so grateful for the reminder, for, Lord, the honesty, that redemption, the faithfulness you call us to, the loyalty that you ask of us is costly. God, we shouldn't be embarrassed about that. We shouldn't be slow to admit it. You're not slow to admit it. Loyalty to you, Lord, will be costly. In some moments, perhaps very costly. And yet, God, I thank you for this powerful and moving reminder in Ruth that if we will display faith in you by being loyal to your covenant, by being faithful to what you have called us to do, that God, in your hands, through that costly loyalty, almost anything is possible. God, I pray that we might be not just moved, but convicted and inspired by the story of Ruth and Boaz. And Lord, I pray that as we reflect on it together, that it might motivate us to demonstrate the same costly loyalty in our own lives. In your name we pray. Amen.